Welcome to Unleash Your Impact, Unlock Others, a podcast about inspiring leadership. We hope to bring you grounded wisdom, stories from real leaders, and leave you feeling inspired. Let's dive in. Hi, this is Dave from Unleash Your Impact, Unlock Others. This is part two of our interview with Seb Shepherd. Now, in part one last week, Seb spoke about growing up in Chile, his time leading expeditions in Patagonia, of all places, and then his time as a helicopter pilot with the Royal Navy. In part two, today's episode, he talks about how he took all of those things, all of the learnings, and applied them to his role as engineering manager inside the Alpine F1 team, where his task was to create a high-performance team. I hope you enjoy this podcast as much as I did talking to him in the first place. So thank you for listening. So how did you go from flying helicopters and all those amazing experiences to high-speed cars? And I know Rich is waiting in the wings. He wants to hear the F1 stories here. Yeah. So how did that transition happen, Seth?
So, yes, I had an eight-year short service commission contract, and it was supposed to be 12, but I decided to take a break after eight because I couldn't see myself either staying in the Navy or flying in the airlines. And this was because I had a very early realization that, yes, I was doing these amazing things and I was being lent these expensive toys, Her Majesty's toys, to go off and do amazing things that were going to last me a lifetime of really good stories and things. But I thought, you know, there's other more interesting things to do. And if I stayed in the Navy, I would have got better at what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know what, I need to try something else. I need to go out and do other things. And if I go to the airlines, it's basically driving a bus in the sky. So it's going to be boring. I thought, no, that's not me either. So I went to, I happened to be stationed in West Scotland, Prestwick at the time, doing search and rescue up in the Highlands.
Yeah.
And we went to Edinburgh, and I ended up getting doing an MBA after I left the Navy. So I did an MBA with literally no plan of what I was going to do. I thought, you know, well, in those days, we barely had internet. So there was none of these sort of online job adverts, or they didn't even have LinkedIn in those days. And so I found myself in London sort of doing various things. Anyway, slightly long story short, but over the years, I ended up working for a company called Lockheed Martin down in Cornwall, looking at the next generation of the helicopters that I used to fly, called the Merlin. And in those days, I'd literally just got married to my wife. And we said, right, you know, because I speak Spanish, and during my time in the Navy, I did an exchange with the Spanish Navy, and I really got the taste for the Spanish culture. And
she's like,
why don't we try looking for a job out in Spain somewhere? Anyway, the planets aligned eventually, and we moved out to Spain, to Seville, to southern Spain. And we ended up staying there for 10 years.
Wow.
In which I was working for Airbus in Seville, building, amongst other things, building the A400M, which is the base of the replacement of the Hercules transport aircraft. And we had an olive farm out there, amazing thing. After which we came back to England, and I worked for, and the first thing that happened was that I got contacted by a company that's a French consultancy, engineering consultancy, that is now, you would now know as Capgemini.
Yeah.
And they said, look, we sponsor this team, this F1 team called Lotus Renault.
Okay.
And we need somebody to come and help us with building or project managing the new car simulator that they've got. And I went, and you've asked me, because I've literally never worked in automotive. So we think that you've got the right background. So they put me in front of the then technical director, a guy called Nick Chester, who now is the technical director of Cadillac, the new F1 team.
Yeah.
And I said to him straight off the bat, I said, look, Nick, I don't want to waste your time, but if you want an expert on cars or anything like that, I'm not that. If you want me to sort out your project of getting the whole project done properly, I'll do so, but don't ask me anything technical because I don't even know how clutch works. he thought this was incredibly funny because nobody can be that cocky to come up with that. Anyway, so I got the gig sort of thing, and I was working for Altron at the time, and I ended up staying there for about 2.5 years with the simulator and various other projects like the gearbox dyno. And eventually I said to Nick, I said, look, I've got to go back to my day job because, you know, there's other things to do. And during that time, which kind of sounds crazy, I know to you, but that I left F1. But I thought, you know, I need to go off and do other things. And I ended up being very involved with the mergers and acquisitions, the integration of the companies that we were buying in Altron at the time.
Yeah.
Lots of little consultancies. And then also with change and transformation. So I was at the head of change and transformation. And at the time, and there's a point to this, what I'm going to say, but at the time, my boss, the CEO, said, look, you know, we've got this problem that we keep buying these consultancies, and then 2 years later, there's practically nothing left of them. So we're not quite sure why is that. As Seb, look, you know, you've got a bit of a reputation of finding out, you know, being able to work on these things and finding the thing. I said, well, actually, to be honest, you don't. I mean, I'll do it, but the solution is quite obvious. So what is it? Well, you're not looking after the people. What do you mean you're not looking after the people? In a consultancy, when you buy a consultancy, the IP of that, the intellectual property of that company is the people.
The people, yeah.
If you don't look after the people, they're going to walk. So what happens when you announce that that big company has just bought little company is that the people in the little company, the first thing that happens when they read that in the news, because nobody's told them that this is happening, is that they go, oh my God, how am I going to pay the mortgage?
Yeah.
And the next thing that happens is that they reach for LinkedIn and they call all their recruitment mates and they say, I'm now looking for a job. And then that means that from the moment go, all the IP is about to walk out of the door. So I said, look, let's start organizing this properly. Before, you know, in an acquisition, normally what happens is that you get your PwCs, the accountants that turn up and they sort of make lots of numbers and say, this is how much the company's worth. And you go like, yeah, I buy it. But nobody looks upstream. So like, we need to plan this integration properly.
Mm.
How are we going to protect the company, the culture, the people? The people tend to stay for a culture. So therefore, how are we going to do that properly? So we said, look, let's start doing it properly. So together with the mothership in France, we set up a team and we had a huge methodology of how to actually do it properly. Months ahead, before anything was even talked about, we would organize the strategy, what's going to happen, proper timeline, proper project managed, and so on, such that half an hour before it was announced to the markets, we'd have a town hall, get everybody together, both CEOs, talk to the teams, go, this is what's about to happen, and Seb is about to manage this whole process, and I'll talk about culture and people and protecting the all of this sort of thing, so that if people were going to walk, at least we could stop them from walking. We would show them, look, your life is about to get better, not worse, because we're going to manage it properly.
Did you? Because I think I've experienced this, not just in my own career in terms of the businesses I've worked for, but also since I've been running my own business, about how badly sometimes businesses do change and transformation. And I agree with you, where they get it wrong more than anywhere is in the people side of it. And what they don't do at all, I don't think, is empathise on how the people feel. No, take some time to understand how the people feel and then show a degree of empathy.
Exactly.
I'm guessing from what you were saying there is that's exactly what you were doing.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I used to do, we had this methodology and it was all sort of very good, practical and so on. And we actually got fairly good validation out of that, because about a year after I started doing this,
yeah,
I actually got invited to give conferences about this to people who'd been doing this for 20 years.
Okay.
Which I thought, well, okay, you know, again, I knew nothing about it a year ago, but now I've obviously hit on something because this is all about people. Anyway, yeah. but one of the things I used to do, which worked really well, and this came from an old boss of mine, is that, again, you know, my boss would say, like, okay, but we've got all these other little problems that we know are there, but we haven't been told by the people who did the due diligence, your PwCs, is that, and I said, yeah, not a problem, you know, and I would, as the head of integration, I would go and sit in that company,
yeah,
but I wouldn't just sit anywhere. I'd purposely work from that company to integrate myself with them, but I would sit right next to where the kitchen or where the coffee machine was.
Okay.
So that everybody goes to the coffee first thing several times a day, and I would get to have chats with people and just get to know them, break down the ice, you know, all that sort of thing. And then eventually after a few weeks, once I was kind of slightly trusted, you know, Seb's okay.
Yeah, he's
right. I'd invite a few of them down to the pub.
Oh, okay.
And I'd buy them a few drinks And by the second pint, they're singing like canaries. I mean, not that you're trying to extract anything bad, but I said to them, look, please be open with me. Tell me all the stuff that the due diligence didn't pick up. Yeah. What are the problems here? What do we need to fix? Yeah. What do we need, as in the same way that I was telling you guys, you know, officially in front of the CEOs, that we want to try this. Tell me, what's the stuff that we really need to fix here?
Yeah.
And they're going, actually, that's a really nice thing to hear, sir, because that means that you're actually truly interested in trying to fix this. I said, okay, right, let's do it. I said, don't worry, you know, your identity will be protected and so on. And then I'll pick all this up and I'll go to my CEO's office. And we always had very candid, open conversations. Closed doors, you know, nothing would escape out there. But I've always been very, very open and honest about the problems. If we don't face open and honest problems, and there's a link to military aviation, which is quite interesting, then we can't move forward. So I used to say, right, this is the stuff that you haven't been told, and this is what we're going to do about it. So therefore, we can get ahead of it. It's not going to become a problem. Or there's a bit of a toxic culture because this is happening and this is happening. And generally, there's one little element that's happening there, and that person is creating a toxic atmosphere because of a problem and so on. So you start to unravel it, but it was a very good way of getting clarity as to what you needed to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now the reason why I made the analogy to naval aviation is that in naval aviation, like in many elite teams and sports and so on, one of the things that they do very well is that they don't just all hop into an aircraft and go flying and then slap each other on the back for doing a good job. You brief very, very thoroughly before you do the flight.
Yeah.
So that everyone knows exactly what they're doing, when they're doing it, what happens if something goes wrong and so on.
Yeah.
And you do it, and then you come back and you debrief thoroughly.
Yeah.
And you go like, yeah, okay, these are the reasons that things went well, but let's look at what could have been better, or something went wrong, or we had an emergency, how did we cope with it, or we did this, or we did that, so that everybody, and it's not that everybody's having snipes at each other or finger pointing.
No.
It's the fact that people understand that it's something called radical candor, which is like, I think Kim Scott wrote that book, but yeah, you've got it on your shelf.
I have.
And it's about getting people to understand that when you have proper debriefs in companies, that you are feeding back stuff so that people can be better. Yeah, and that's the analogy there, is that you're telling people how to become better at their jobs because you want them to grow. And this coming back to Daniel Pink is that you want them to be better at their jobs because at some point you want them to grow, become ready for their next job, their next assignment, their next promotion, whatever it is. But that again, companies always think like that just by doing one review a year, that's fine. You have to have constant feedback. And people, and as humans, we constantly crave feedback.
Yeah.
In everything we do. Yeah. We want to start a singing career, and we want honest feedback from somebody, not just somebody going like, yeah, you're doing really well, because they're not doing you a favor. Because in my case, if I started singing, all my friends started going, like, yeah, mate, that's really good. Whereas I know that I've got lots of mates who go like, mate, don't get back to the helicopter. Exactly. But it's the same in businesses, and I've had to unravel horrendous things in F1 where you know, some engineers, you know, 3 years out of university, have been with the wrong manager, and they've constantly been told, oh, no, what you're doing is fantastic, well done, well done, well done, because they don't want to have the difficult conversation. They don't want to give bad feedback. And they keep reinforcing, they keep sort of not touching on the bits that they could be better.
Why is that, though? I mean, listening to you talk about all of these experiences and some really, to me, it's like common sense. You know, build trust, build relationships, try and understand what makes other people tick, what they're concerned about, the importance of preparation, briefing, debriefing, all of the things that you've talked about to me is like, well, that's just common sense. But it's not common practice. It doesn't happen, as you well know. Why is that? Are we just too obsessed with goals and outcomes and money? Or is there something else going? Why do you think businesses don't do this stuff?
There's always a... I think there's a because the focus in business is always about money, 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 delivery. People obsess about that, and they forget that time spent with your team or talking about how you can become better is as valuable as the actual sort of delivery of. If you look at any elite sport, I mean, for example, tennis players, they train to a peak, and then they rest and they train. up to peak, and then the rest, and so on. Businesses should be reasonably the same in that you don't always operate at 100% and then peak up to 120 and come down to 100.
Yeah.
No, you have to have time to be able to maintain the engine, if you want. Is that, and maintaining the engine and maintaining the people there is about communication. And that communication has to be obviously two-way in that the, again, coming back to the whole thing about humans wanting feedback.
Yeah.
You know, if you're at any level, I want to start doing things and I want to understand whether people around me are not just going like, oh my God, what's he doing? He's driving himself or us into the ground, but we don't have the psychological safety to be able to raise our hand and say, stop. Is that we want to have that, are we doing the right thing, guys? Are you doing the right thing? If you're out of university, you just want, you're full of, you know, motivation and want to do well, but you're not, you don't know whether you're just doing 70% well, 90% well, or 150% well. And because sometimes you have a lot of motivation, but maybe going in the wrong direction. So having that feedback and having the psychological safety of being able to talk to people without them running off to HR saying, oh, I'm being talked nastily by my boss.
Yeah.
No. It's all about, because we want to make you better. We want to make you a better person. By you being a better engineer, better whatever your job is, the team is better. And I want you guys also to tell me, am I doing the right thing?
We need to learn the lessons of the. I mean, I remember going to an event probably 10 years before COVID, certainly 8 years before COVID, where some research was presented that, you know, the vast majority of people wanted some degree of hybrid working, flexible working, yet only 10% of companies were really offering it. Of course, COVID comes along, and overnight, bang, what happens? There has now been, and has been for quite some time, a groundswell of opinion that actually people do care about well-being. They want their well-being looked after. But as business really, is it another one where we just aren't catching up? We aren't realising this is important? Because, as you said, if you do the well-being bit properly, the performance will follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, again, in F1, we haven't even got to where
no,
but in F1, one of the things I did, because it wasn't in place in the company, I said, right, you know, we need to have a look at the well-being of people, because part of there's a huge sort of thing that I had to do there. But one of them was, right, we need to do well-being, but we need to, I wanted to do it in a very different way that most companies do it. Most companies think that you know, you're the head of HR or the department head, and you have to say, right, this is your well-being. Off you go and do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a few bits and bobs in the office and everybody's super happy well-being. No, I said, no, let's do it differently. Ultimately, I don't know what makes people happy and comfortable to work in this office. And so I asked each one of my managers, please.
This is when you were an engineering manager at Alpine.
Correct. Yeah.
So you've gone there as head of engineering or head of engineering manager. Yeah. As you said, not knowing about fast cars, and that wasn't your technical area of expertise.
Indeed.
But what you're good at is the people bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll come back to the story about how I got there. But I got each one of my managers. I said, right, nominate one person or ask for volunteers, young engineers, from each section, and there were seven of them. And actually, we got more than one in each section. But anyway, we got into a room, and I closed the door, and I said, right, you guys are now the well-being team.
Okay, yeah.
But you are the team, not me.
Yeah.
You are. I'm just here once a month to come and listen to you, and I'm going to enable anything that you tell me. So I want you all to go off and talk amongst yourselves, but talk to your teams and get feedback. What would make us a better place to work in, to be able to thrive, to be able to be comfortable working, to have psychological safety, to look out for each other, because we work in a very, very high intense, high working environment.
Yeah.
So look out, make sure that we're looking out, so that we catch people who are not having a good time, or they're hiding, they're not wanting to come up with things that are driving them down. We want to be at our best all the time, so that we can be a better unit to be able to fight for championships.
Yeah.
And by doing that, then they all came back, and then over the years we they would feedback, and they said, right, if we did this in the office, or if we had that in the office, or if we put these kind of posters around the place and so on, it would make us a happier, better place. And then we they and And basically, I would once a month, I'd turn up and together with my boss, we'd sit down there, closed door. Anything that was said in there was completely in confidence. And we kept that. But we would enable anything they wanted to do.
What sort of things were they asking for? And it's interesting to, you know, that they must have come up with things that you allude at. Sometimes it's quite small things. Sometimes it might be bigger things. But yeah. What was important to them?
So it was. I mean, simple things like, for example, right, by this stage, we'd completely changed the layout of the office. We went from little tiny, tiny little silos, sort of spaced out open plan office to a completely open plan office. Mm-hmm. So they said, like, it looks a little bit drab. Can we have some plants? Yeah. How much would it cost? Right, there you go. Go and buy. Let's go and buy plants. But let's organize somebody to go and buy plants. Not Seb goes and organizes plants. Yeah. It's like, get everybody involved in the process. Because if they're involved in the shaping of the well-being, and by having these people representatives from each department and having going into their teams, they're shaping their own well-being. By shaping their own well-being, they're manufacturing their own happiness, their own well-being. Therefore, they're responsible for it. And that's a whole almost reverse psychology, if you want, is that normally managers tend to sort of, oh, right, I'll go off and buy the plants and I'll go off and do this. Yeah. No. Here's time. You need time to do this? Okay, I'm empowering you to go off and do this.
Absolutely, yeah.
But by doing that, they own it. It's theirs. So if it goes wrong, they'll feel, oh, gosh, this is not just Seb's messed it up. It's like, it's our collective thing. So... And they were asking for, you know, because it was all about making sure that we could look after each other also. So we were doing all sorts of courses about how to spot if somebody's about to have a breakdown or you know, burnout or whatever, to having to teach the managers to spot these things, how to manage people properly, all the way through to can we? In fact, here's a really good one. Because we are indoors quite a lot, especially over winter months, which is the peak of the work in engineering. And we didn't have proper skylights on those days in the factory. They said, look, can we have vitamin D tablets? I said, yeah. How many do you want? So we bought vitamin D tablets for everybody, one on each desk. If you didn't want to take it, you didn't have to, but it was there. And then it was right. And when we redid the whole layout of the office, we asked them, right, what kind of things do we want? What kind of posters do we want? What kind of feel? What kind of ambience? What kind of openness do we want? What kind of communications? It seemed to work quite well.
Just by asking, listening, empowering.
Exactly.
Did you have the authority to just make anything happen, or did you have to persuade people above you that stuff needed to change?
One of the nice things about F1, and this is almost the whole purpose of my consultancy, is about having the F1 mindset.
Right.
But what do I mean by that is that in F1, they understand that things have to change so fast that any kind of process gets in the way of that.
Okay.
So you have to be able to make decisions very, very fast based on data that you have, which might not always be perfect.
No.
And you will get some things wrong. But that's all part of the psychological safety of understanding that some things will go wrong.
Yeah.
But the whole point of F1 is that you can it's unlike normal businesses where you've got an idea, you have to do a business plan, and then goes to 10 committees,
right.
And then we don't have the budget, and then before you know it, your competition's gone straight past.
Yeah.
In F1, that's taken to an nth degree, because we've got an idea, and luckily in F1, you've got quite a lot of money to spend. So it's not so much nowadays, but there's... So you just do it. You literally just do it, because... It's a good thing to do, and it takes you in the right way. And normally in F1, you can always associate whatever money you're spending into how fast is that going to make the car around the track. When it comes to people, it's very difficult. It's a very subjective thing.
It is.
How happy does somebody have to be for that to translate to? But what you have to remember as a leader of a company is that the more that you invest in your people, the happiness to be in the office, working long hours, invested in the problem, trying to go the extra mile, trying to motivate others, is directly relevant to or impacted by the culture that you have, the behaviors that you set, by the empowerment that you give, the motivation, the purpose, how you act as a boss, all these sort of things.
I remember when we first talked as well, you said when you went into that engineering role, there wasn't really a culture of development planning, career developing people, succession planning, career ladder, all that. Just talk about that a little bit in terms of how you tackled that issue.
So yeah, so coming back to what we missed, but so after doing all this stuff with Altran and these mergers and acquisitions and so on, my old boss Nick Chester calls me up again, and we used to have lunch every so often. So he says, "Look, we've got this big problem. So I want you to come and sort of put your name in the hat to be the engineering manager." And I said, "Like, mate, you do remember that. One, I'm not an engineer.
Yeah.
Second, I don't know anything about cars."
Yeah.
And he laughed. And he said, "Look, the reason that the problem that we have is that we are a collection, in those days, 120 engineers,
right,
the best in the planet."
Yeah.
"And that engineers, if left to their own devices, are very good at engineering anything, all the way down. They'll get themselves into the rabbit hole as far as they can before you drag them out. So they're very good at that, but they're not very good at organizing themselves."
Okay.
So he said, "Look, please come and have a look, because we've got all sorts of problems, chief amongst which is that we can't even get the interns to stay for a job." I went, "Oh, that doesn't sound very good."
No.
Anyway, so I turned up, and when I took a look around, I went, like, "God, this is quite structural. This is not just about quick fixes." So I had to go into my boss's office and say, "Look, we've got a big issue. We've got to fix the structure of the engineering office, because there's a reason why the interns don't want to stay." And it basically, and what happened was that, again, on the back of the basis of talking to people, down at the grassroots level problem, to understand what's going on, but like I was saying in the example early on, is that I said, "Right, first of all, I've been told we don't know why the interns don't want to stay." So I said, "Well, has anybody asked them?" "Not sure." So I said, "Right," I got three of the interns and said, bought them a coffee, and we went round, run for a walk. I said, "Guys, level with me, you know, why do you not want to stay?" And I said, "Well, it's very easy. This is like, there's no structure, there's no proper plans, it's completely chaotic, there's no prioritization. We don't know, I mean, we're changing what we're doing every day. There's no career planning, there's no development, there's just the odd sort of bit of training, but completely irrelevant. There's no career path that we know of. Everybody's got a different job title, and there's kind of, we don't know when we're going to get the next promotion or a bonus. So we're kind of just working very, very hard. And bear in mind that we've, as engineers, we work very hard just to get here.
Mm.
We want a bit of structure. We want to understand what's going on." I said, "Well, that's easy to fix." I said, "Bear with me for 2 months. And if you still feel the same way, you'll go away with my blessing. But please give me those 2 months." So went to my boss and said, "Right, first priority, we need to stop this bleed, because the amount of money it costs us and time and effort. I mean, in F1, even the youngest engineer has got a 6 month garden period leave, as a notice period.
Yeah.
And the senior ones have got 12 months. So if somebody leaves, you have to then hire somebody, and then you've got to wait 6 months minimum, or 12 months sometimes. So it's a huge amount of time to have somebody not a gap in the team."
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, so I basically went out there and I asked HR, and they kind of looked at me, well that's your responsibility. I went, okay. And so I then literally over a weekend I created a career path with very simple steps, clear roles and responsibilities in each step.
Yeah.
And then I said, right, and we're going to have a development plan for each one of those. So, and the other thing I did was that I counted how many different job titles there were. 120 people, 31 different job titles.
Okay.
And I counted down to 6.
Right.
Because I said, look, you can call yourself chief coffee maker if you want, but you are going to be in one of these 6 positions. And then from then on, every single person, and then I had to work with our managers to kind of get them trained up properly, how to manage teams and people and leadership, mm-hmm. and so on. So we set up a whole sort of things for them for that. But more importantly was about, right, every single person on the team is going to have a development plan. By having a development plan, that means that we will, that everybody understands that it's in their hands. First of all, you have a piece of paper, mm-hmm. that had a plot. The first thing was a plot. Now, 3 years and 5 years on the x-axis, and the y-axis was knowledge, experience, position, title, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And we first thing we would ask somebody is, where do you want to be in 3 years, and where do you want to be in 5 years' time? And from and the plan...
Could they answer that question?
That was part of the thing. Is that first of all, you have to go off and think about that. Where do you want to be? And generally, it would be like, I want to be a senior engineer, or I want to be this, or I want to experience a different department or whatever. But then I said right. And then the next point was to develop the exact plan of what they were going to do. And people used to say, well, what's the point of that? I said, well, the point of that is several. Is that one, by taking an interest in somebody's development, you are helping shape where they want to go in life.
Yes.
Which doesn't often happen. But secondly, if they tell you, right, in 3 years' time, I want to be working in a different department, that's okay. It's okay for people to have ambition, because then at least you've got 2 or 3 years to not only prepare that person to do that, but they will then... Then it gives you 2 years to go and find a replacement for that person, or train a replacement even better.
Yeah.
And then by doing that also, that you're invested in their development. I can absolutely guarantee to you that if you are, as a manager, if you're invested in somebody's development, they're going to give you more loyalty than anything else. And the validation to that was probably one of the best professional moments in my life was... couple of years later, when we had this exceptionally good junior engineer, and I mean very good, and we'd already done a development plan for him, and you know, with all these sort of good things, and he turns up one morning, and Alpina those days weren't doing particularly well, with sort of mid-ranking thereabouts, and he said, look, I've just been offered a job, and I want to put my notice in because I've been offered a job with X team that are world champions. And I said, okay, that's fine, let's go and have a coffee. So I went out and had a coffee, and I said, well, tell me, what are your thoughts? I said, well, you know, I want to experience as an engineer to be in a world championship team. I said, okay, that's fair enough. Okay, you go with my blessing.
Yeah.
But before you go, I want you to go with your eyes open. So yeah, no, that's fair enough. I said, right, the team that you're going to will not give you any development. They're going to pigeonhole you in exactly the place that you're good at, which is, in those days, it was something to do with suspension.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be very happy. But I said, but look, you know,
right.
Bear in mind that, you know, he said, look, I'm really torn because you guys have been so good at helping develop, you know, and I knew where I was going and all this. I said, no, that's fine. I said, but don't take my word for it. On Monday, one of the people from that team is coming to come and work for us. And I want you to have a conversation with him.
Okay.
That's it. That's all I said.
Yeah.
Monday morning, buy them both a coffee. I said, off you go. Go and talk. Anyway, 25 minutes later, he comes in and says, can I have my letter back? I don't want to leave anymore. I said, that guy told me exactly what you told me. He said, I wouldn't get any promotion because they stopped promotions. I would be pigeonholed for the next 5-10 years. I wouldn't have any development. And whereas here, I know exactly where I'm going with my development. I'm going to be a better engineer in 5 years' time. And also... more importantly, and I told him, well, you might be in a team that's world champion, but they've already got there. They don't need you to come and change the world. So they don't want to tweak too much. Whereas with us, you can experiment, you can do things, because the journey to becoming a world champion is what you will enjoy. It's not being there for the photograph. The photograph's the validation, but having the trophy, but...
But I think it comes back to that Daniel Pink conversation we had earlier on, doesn't it? About you can get very, very swayed by extrinsic things, you know, perks, money, all sorts of stuff. Yeah, I mean, if you worked in F1, who wouldn't want to feel like they worked for the best, most successful team? But that's a bit of an ego-driven decision. But actually, if you worked in a team where it was exciting, you're doing your best work, you get into flow regularly, you have autonomy, you're being developed, you have a sense of purpose, all the things that Daniel Pink talks about, actually, for a lot of people, that is the best place to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I'm not sure that's how things are presented in organisations generally.
That's certainly the purpose of what I'm trying to do with my business, and I know you are too, is that to try and instill a little bit more the F1 mindset of, like, you know, how can we drive teams and leaders especially to do all of these things in their companies without the fear of going, oh no, wait, you know, the CFO coming and saying, you're wasting time and on, you know, why are you spending money on buying people coffee and stuff like that? Well, that's a waste of money. It's like, no, that's all part of an investment. You're investing in stuff. You know, investing in people should be seen as almost like a capex.
Yeah.
There is a return on investment in that.
Yeah. So you've now you've now started your own business, you've left the world of F1 behind you, you have this amazing career of all sorts of different experiences and what have you. What do you see the next 5 or 10 years looking like for you in terms of what do you want to achieve now in helping other people learn the stuff that you've learned?
I mean, this came about slightly because I was on Gardenly for 12 months and yeah. I don't want to get bored. So I started reaching out to, I was traveling around Australia and I just happened to be in Australia for the first race last year. And I reached out to Melbourne Uni.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you know, I'm from F1 and do you fancy me coming to talk to your MBA? I said, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I sort of made up a talk and with one of the professors there. It was actually on reputational leadership, in fact. But I talked about all of these things, and they liked it so much that they asked me to stay on as a visiting professor, sorry, lecturer. Mm. And then that started sort of every. I went to Chile and I got the same thing, when I came back to England, I sort of knocked on a couple of doors, and lo and behold, the same thing happened. You know, before I knew it, I was talking to all these professors, and suddenly they invited me to give talks in their classes, and this went down really well. And when I did my MBA. I would have loved to have had somebody like me with the experience of the stuff I've been through to come and talk to me, because in universities, a lot of the time they've got this amazing theoretical knowledge, but they don't talk so much about the practical applications of. Suddenly it's like, yeah, all this theory, but this theory sometimes doesn't match up to the reality of you know, having to deal with difficult conversations or with unions or with yeah. cultures or with people, whatever. But So I kind of found that not only the people that I was talking to at unis, which are generally sort of senior managers from all sorts of walks of life and different cultures and countries and so on, but there was quite a good practical application to it. Mm. And that's the kind of thing I'm trying to do, is be able to, I want to try and sort of turn the whole sort of F1 mindset, the elite thing of how do these amazing leaders and these groups of people, how do they get there? What kind of, how do they treat people? How do they do things? How do they shape themselves in order to be able to become elite, become high performance and so on? And this is especially relevant in today's world because, and this is part of a talk I gave at Oxford Uni recently, is that the whole age of AI at the moment
yeah.
is completely transforming things. Whereas before, you know, the barriers to entry in a lot of industries were very, very high. Therefore, you know, the companies were reasonably safe.
Yeah.
Nowadays, in a lot of cases, a 22-year-old with a laptop and knowing how to do agents can leapfrog you within a weekend. Mm-hmm. And businesses are still stuck in the whole, like, oh, well, you've got a really good idea. Right, let's put a business plan together. Let's do it through committee. And before you know it, they're like...
It's too late.
They've gone like, mate, you don't even realize that I, as a 25-year-old with this idea about AI, you know, I'm just going to go off and work for my mate down the road because in 3 years' time, we're going to beat you. Mm. And that is so relevant nowadays. So the whole point is trying to get this, if businesses can understand this new mentality that they need to do in order to completely slash processes.
Yeah.
In order to not faff around with the fact that you have to submit your expenses and you spend 30 minutes a week submitting expenses or the travel report or this report or that report. I mean, how many businesses nowadays, you know, somebody will spend 2 days doing a slide deck, having a meeting, only for somebody not to turn up to that meeting, summarizing the whole thing in 5 bullet points and go like, and think that they've been there. Just do the 5 bullet points and speak for 5 minutes about it instead of doing that whole preparation. All these kind of things are just big sort of wake-up calls, really.
So you're talking about being much more agile, aren't you? I think
the
world that the way it is and where we think it's going, agility and leadership for you is one of the big things, which I'm guessing, going back to your story about F1, you said that's what we had to do it that way.
Yeah.
Because, okay, so really interesting. In terms of anybody listening to this podcast today and they're thinking, wow, yeah, there's so much I could learn from Seb's experiences, where do I start? What would be your sort of key tips for somebody thinking, right, I know I need to be more agile. I get the point. It's all about people. I need to invest in the people more. What would be your starting point, your top tips?
Well, it depends what part of your career you're in. If you're a young leader or aspiring leader, there's so much that you can learn from. I mean, there's thousands of business books out there.
Yeah.
And probably soon one, I'll probably add one soon enough. But there's, it's just, learn how to deal with people, as in don't be afraid to have difficult conversations with people, but frame it in the way that you're not criticizing somebody. Frame it in the fact that you're trying to make people better at their work.
Mm-hmm.
And having difficult conversations is probably the most difficult thing that you can do as a leader.
Absolutely. Yeah?
But take time to spend with people. You know, having a conversation about the football for 20 minutes on a Monday morning with your team is not time wasted. It's asking them about their pets or their family or whatever is an okay thing.
Mm.
Because they're spending probably more time with you in the office than they are with their own family. So therefore, try and make it a nice place. And the more interest that you spend on people, and also mainly on their careers, the more loyal they'll be to you and to your team. And you know, you guys know this very well, that you know, people leave bad managers, not bad companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And toxic environments come from bad managers.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas our whole strapline is built around that, and if you want a better world, that means we need better organizations, and that comes with better leaders. that's the whole point, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
So Seb, where can people find out more about you, connect with you, find out more about the work that you're doing?
So I've got a website. It's called sebshepard.com. I'm sure that you'll put the link. Or otherwise, if you can't find that, it's f1mindset.com. I love people's input as to what they think of it.
Engage. You're on LinkedIn as well,
I'm guessing. Also on LinkedIn.
I've seen you put some really interesting infographics using your F1 experience on LinkedIn.
And that's been quite fun, actually, to be able to use modern tools that are there nowadays to kind of try and summarize some of these things and putting nice infographics there. Because it's always good to be able to share these things out there.
Yeah, I love the idea of trying to bring the F1 mindset into everyday work. So for me, I'm just looking at there's a load of things that stand out from this conversation, but there's three things here. Empathy is not soft, because too often Rich and I will hear, oh, that's the soft and fluffy nonsense here. Empathy is not soft, and it drives productivity. You've proved that more than once in your career, yeah? Stability and trust is foundations for high performance. Make sure, trust particularly, yeah? And the last thing you said, adaptability and speed in decision-making. In this age of AI, we've got to move quicker, decide quicker. If we get things wrong, we can adapt and move on and learn a lesson and move on, can't we?
Indeed.
Those three things, would make most people a better leader if they could implement those.
There's so much you can do, but all of these things are basic. And the point I'm trying to make to businesses, as I'm sure you are too, is that all of these things are attainable. They're not just some magic sauce that you know, F1 teams and Olympic rowers and you know, the All Blacks or the England rugby team have. They don't just go and buy it somewhere. They are literally simple, everyday things that anybody out there can do.
Can do, yeah. Well, say, I said it earlier on, didn't I? A lot of this is common sense, but it's not common practice.
Mm.
Yeah. So, Seb, thank you so much for coming down today to meet with us, sharing these incredible stories and insights from your life and career. You know, for all the roles you've had, you know, it leaps out at me that everything that's optimal and sustainable about performance starts with people.
Indeed.
Well, and I totally agree with you on that. So anybody listening, if you've enjoyed this conversation I've had with Seb, please subscribe to Seb's website, you know, connect with him on LinkedIn, and please share this podcast with anybody else you think might find it interesting. But for today, Seb, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.